Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke recently told Congress that interest rates likely would remain exceptionally low for an extended period. Well, that was great news for borrowers, but not for savers. Risk-averse people who shun stocks and bonds have often turned to government-insured certificates of deposit. Traditionally, you'd tie up your money for a while, anywhere from 3 months to 5 years, in return for a steady, reliable payout. But these days, CD interest rates are so low, savers feel cheated. Here to discuss the saver's dilemma is NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn G. Wax. Marilyn, it's great to see you again.
Hi, Leanne. It's good to be back.
All right. Explain. Why are interest rates so low?
These rock-bottom interest rates we're seeing, they're really a reflection of how weak the economy still is. When the financial crisis hit in the fall of 2008, the Federal Reserve decided that it would have to help the economy by slashing interest rates. And at that time, you know, the stock market was tanking, housing was doing very poorly. So they wanted to try to make it easier for borrowers to get loans. But that strategy of propping up borrowers has a cost, and savers were the ones who had to pay it. So in late 2008, if you put your money into the bank in the form of a CD, okay, you did your part to help the economy by making cash available, but you just didn't get much of a reward.
But all signs seem to point to the fact that the worst of the crisis is over. So why not raise rates now?
Well, it's definitely true that in the past year, the economy has stabilized, but stabilized is not great. It's still a very difficult environment. The housing market's very fragile, and if you raised interest rates, that'd just make that market a lot worse. That means here we are. We're stuck in a very low-rate period for a very long time. These days, if you could get even 1.5% interest on a one-year CD, that's pretty good.
But what about your if you're willing to tie up your money for longer than 1 year? I mean, can you get more interest in exchange for a longer commitment?
Yes, you can. But, you know, that's only if you're willing to tie up your money for 5 years. And then even at that, you're only getting 3% interest. That's really not much of a return. And there's one other thing to consider. In an economy that's still as weak as this one, do you really want to tie up your money for 5 years? What if you lost your job later this year? A lot of people who thought they'd never lose their jobs did. So sometimes you might need that money.
But couldn't you put your money in a 5-year CD now and then pull it out if you had an emergency?
Yes, you could get your money back, but you're going to pay huge penalties. The withdrawal penalties, if you take your money out of a CD, you could wipe out every bit of interest you earn. And depending on the circumstances, it's even possible that you could lose some of the principal. That is the money you originally put in.
Marilyn, pardon me, but this isn't fair. This doesn't sound fair if you're a person who wants to save money.
You know, it isn't fair. Actually, it's really frustrating for savers. You know, the consumers, the homeowners, the businesses that borrowed way too much money a decade ago, they left the economy in terrible shape. And it was so bad that the Fed had no choice but to bail them out by driving interest rates lower. But the end result is that savers, who are the very people who did not cause this financial crisis, are now the people who are getting puny returns on their money.
NPR senior business editor Marilyn G. Wax. Marilyn, thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome, Leanne.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. On the internet, the need for privacy runs alongside the need to connect. This coming week, denizens of the web will descend on Austin, Texas for the South by Southwest Interactive Festival. I am a new member of the social media community, as my thousands of Twitter followers can attest. So I'm heading to the festival, not just to get my feet wet, but to cannonball into the pool of gamers, gurus, and geeks. I won't be in the host chair for the next Weekend Edition. Instead, I'll be in the studios of member station KUT to tell Audie Cornish and you all about it. I'll also bring back a few stories for future broadcasts. And when I return, a very important person in my life and the life of this program won't be here. Devar Iran Ardalan, whom I've known since she first graced the halls of NPR and the edit booths of this show, with her extraordinary talent and boundless energy. Professionally, for the past few years, she has been at the helm of this ship we call Weekend Edition, and she's guided us through the dangerous shoals of budget cuts and shortages. Devar has also taught me how to swim in the deep waters of Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. I have a new connection to you because of her. She'll be dropping anchor for a while in the safe harbor of her home and family, but it won't be long before she sets sail again for different shores. All I can say is thank you, bon voyage, arg, and don't forget to tweet.
The red carpet is rolling out as we speak in Hollywood ahead of tomorrow night's 82nd Annual Academy Awards.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain.
I'm gonna level with you. We can't get married at all.
Why not?
I'm a man.
Well, nobody's perfect.
I'm Spartacus.
That's Spartacus. Some Like It Hot, Psycho, and Singin' in the Rain. Four classic films. Bob Mondello, what do all those movies have in common?
Not one of them was nominated for Best Picture.
Not one. That's NPR's film critic Bob Mondello in the studio with me. And we asked him to come by because we were wondering why some classic films get neglected by the Academy. Bob, good to have you back.
It's always a pleasure.
Okay, so we just heard clips from these films that I think most people would say, you know, are among the most recognizable of their eras. And you have a whole list here of other movies that have been neglected.
I do. Just listen to this. These are pictures that were not nominated for Best Picture. Vertigo, Rear Window, North by Northwest.
Vertigo, Rear Window. All films by Alfred Hitchcock.
Right. And they must have it in for him.
And these are like the first films that film students study.
Yes. He never won as a director. One of his pictures did win Best Picture. It was Rebecca. But that award went to the producer, David O. Selznick. Anyway, here's a couple of others. Breakfast at Tiffany's, The Dirty Dozen, Last Tango in Paris, Serpico, Rebel Without a Cause.
Bob, I'm shocked. Well, yeah. None of those movies were nominated for Best Picture.
Not one. I think it's really egregious. You would think that something fabulous would have bumped them out.
Yeah.
The Dirty Dozen was bumped by Rex Harrison riding a pink snail in Dr. Doolittle. Last Tango in Paris and Serpico were bumped by a picture that nobody really remembers anymore called The Touch of Class.
Never heard of it.
Yeah. It's like a nothing little comedy.
It sounds like a flower shop.
Yeah, well, that's fair. The most egregious example of all is that Oliver won for Best Picture in 1968.
That's a musical.
Yes, and it was a perfectly sweet musical, but kind of okay. And what was not nominated that year was 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Wow.
Arguably one of the great pictures ever.
So how is it that films that we now consider essential, classics, you know, get left out?
Well, frequently, in the case of something like Last Tango or Serpico or something like that, the Academy tends to shy away from things that are either overtly sexual or are really violent.
Which is why Last Tango in Paris wasn't nominated. Films like Pulp Fiction even?
Yeah.
But that was nominated.
That got nominated but it didn't win.
Right.
And I think those kinds of pictures have a problem just sort of generally. And that's because the folks who are voting for these tend to be a good deal older than the general public. Mm-hmm. I mean, movies are made for 18 to 26-year-olds, basically.
Right.
That's the prime audience. The people voting for the Oscars include Mickey Rooney, Shirley Temple, Kirk Douglas. I mean, this is not to say that they aren't forward-thinking and fabulous and youthful at heart,
right,
but they're not the same as the audience.
And Bob, you're mentioning obviously a lot of actors, and actors presumably make up a pretty big segment of the people who vote.
Yes, this is true. There are many more actors than there are directors, and because they're the biggest chunk of the Academy, they also wield a lot of influence. And they, in fact, tend to go for actors' pictures. You'll see something like Kramer versus Kramer gets a nod over Apocalypse Now,
right,
because Apocalypse Now is a director's picture. It's Francis Ford Coppola showing off and is fabulous and all that kind of thing. But Kramer versus Kramer is a sort of a domestic drama that shows off actors, and actors get into that a lot.
Yeah, and then Raging Bull, which is, again, considered
perfect
a classic,
example.
Lost to Ordinary People.
Exactly. It's exactly the same kind of thing. And Ordinary People is a good picture,
yeah.
Right? But it doesn't really hold up the way that Raging Bull does. Raging Bull was regarded as one of the great pictures of that decade.
So if it favors actors' films, does it suggest that a movie like The Hurt Locker might win tomorrow night versus, you know, a sweeping, huge director's film like Avatar?
It does, in fact, suggest that. Avatar is a big, splashy picture. But I tell you, if I were an actor and I were looking at Avatar, I would realize how unimportant I was to that. Because me with a blue tail and 9 feet tall and an elongated face, not quite the same as
you get
me.
A lot of attention in the building.
Yeah, well, that's true.
That's NPR film critic Bob Mondello. Bob, thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think were the least deserved Oscar wins in history, and who got snubbed? Join the conversation at npr.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Mitt Romney's fiery speech at the Conservative Political Action Conference last month seemed to signal what could be another bid for the presidency. In his address, the 2008 Republican presidential candidate and former Massachusetts governor railed against what he sees as the Obama administration's missteps. That theme is reiterated in his new book called No Apology, The Case for American Greatness. It's a 300-page treatise filled with ideas for the economy, foreign policy, and national security. Mitt Romney is in our New York bureau. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you, Leanne. Good to be with you.
So is all of this leading up to an announcement?
You know, it's just not decided at this point, and I'm probably not going to make that decision until well after the November elections. The real job is to try and get some balance in Washington again by electing some conservative senators and congresspeople, which is an effort I'm doing my best to get underway this year.
The title of the book, No Apology, does that have anything to do with the criticisms you've had of President Obama's foreign policy?
It does to a degree, and then more than that as well. But I was very critical of the fact that from the very early days of his administration, the president embarked on a tour where he said that America has been dismissive and divisive and arrogant. At the same time, the broader purpose of this book is to describe my view that America is facing some real challenges. That's our overspending, our overdependence on foreign oil, the weakness in our schools, the weakness in the foundations of our national productivity and economy, the atrophy that is occurring in some parts of our military. It's not going to be easy, but the tough road ahead typically makes us stronger.
I want to go back to the idea of your criticism of President Obama's foreign policy, it being failed. Could it not be argued that many saw his approach as making amends in the face of a failed foreign policy?
It's always possible to make amends with a number of gestures to other nations. But I think it's a startling thing when, for instance, the British media says that never in the history of America has an American president gone on foreign soil and been so critical of his home nation. I think that's a mistake.
I'd like to talk about the economy. I find it interesting, given that you have a business background. You were once CEO of a major management consulting firm. Your supporters refer to you as Mr. Fix-It. So, Mr. Fix-It, what's your prescription then for fixing the economy?
You know, first of all, TARP has served its purpose. I'd take the funding that's still left in TARP, and instead of using it as a slush fund, I'd say we're going to use that to pay down our debt. Secondly, the stimulus, I'd fix the stimulus rather than passing another stimulus. $787 billion worth of current stimulus is a backbreaking amount of debt that we're going to owe to the Chinese and others. It's the wrong way to have gone in a way that was not as effective as it could have been. What would have been more effective? Well, because the consumer segment of our economy was frankly frightened, the corporate side would have been a far more effective place to create stimulus. So you could have said, we're going to let businesses expense their capital expenditures entirely in the very first year. We're also going to put in place far more robust investment tax credits to encourage small businesses, large businesses to buy more stuff like new buildings, new equipment, cars, and so forth immediately. And as they do so, they're putting more people to work in the businesses that supply those goods.
I'm speaking with the former governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, and he was also a former Republican presidential candidate. I want to talk about health care, because in your book, No Apology, you are critical of President Obama's approach to overhauling health care legislation. Now, when you were governor of Massachusetts, you oversaw a statewide universal coverage plan. Given your experience, what is the president doing wrong?
Well, first of all, we solved the uninsured problem at the state level with federal support as we received in our state. Number two, you do not put in place a plan that's going to raise taxes on the American people. Raising taxes kills jobs. It causes employers to pull back. It's the wrong way to go. Number three, we did not reduce Medicare and put a burden on senior citizens as the president's plan does. That's the wrong way to go. And finally, we did not create a public option, if you will, a government insurance plan. Fortunately, the president's backed away from that as a result of a lot of pressure from the American people. And I really think in the final analysis, even if he's able to push this through a partisan nuclear option, the American people are going to reject it.
But doesn't that plan, President Obama's plan, almost mirror the one you oversaw as governor back in 2006?
Well, I just described all the ways it doesn't. His raises taxes, mine didn't. His cuts Medicare, mine didn't. His is done at a federal level, mine is done at a state-by-state level. So in those three elements alone, it's a dramatically different plan. The idea that we're going to add another entitlement in a nation that's overwhelmed right now with entitlement liability, we didn't do that in Massachusetts.
Inasmuch as any group needs a leader, who do you think is leading the GOP right now?
Well, you know, when you have the White House, the president really is the spokesperson, the leader of the party that has the White House, and that's what the Democrats have now. When you don't have the White House, of course you have the prominent elected leaders, but you're seeing a lot of other voices that come forward. Some new governors that were just elected, Bob McDonnell in Virginia, Chris Christie in New Jersey, in Massachusetts, Scott Brown. And then, of course, people like Senator McCain and Sarah Palin and Mike Huckabee, Tim Pawlenty. People listen to those different voices, and ultimately we're probably going to settle on a nominee probably a year and a half or two from now. And at that point, that will be the person who represents our party.
Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, the title of his new book is No Apology, The Case for American Greatness. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
Television shows like The West Wing have been ripping stories from the headlines for years. But lately, that equation is moving in reverse. In the past few weeks, Washington insiders have been riveted by newspaper and magazine stories about President Obama and his relationship with Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel. Some stories say Emanuel is too powerful. Others portray a White House dominated by campaign staffers in which Emanuel's pragmatic advice on health care and the economy is ignored. It's a storyline almost identical to a fictional one during the first season of The West Wing.
Mandy wrote an instruction manual for Russell, and it's out there somewhere.
That's actress Allison Janney, who played White House Press Secretary C.J. Gregg. In that episode, the staffers who work for President Bartlet find out that a reporter is about to print a story detailing the relationship between the president and his chief of staff, Leo McGarry.
How bad is it?
Well, she takes the three of us to town. We don't look like rocket scientists, but then again, we're not rocket scientists.
Who is it bad for?
President, Leo. President and Leo.
We don't know who has this?
I'm talking to everybody in the room.
Do it quietly.
And quickly. Whose paper is it in tomorrow? We have to know right away.
Yeah.
The episode detailed what's known as a process story, a story not about policy or even debate, but a look at the tension behind the scenes.
I think it suggests how, in some ways, Washington is predictable because there are so many stories in the TV show that preceded real life.
That's Dee Dee Myers. She was President Clinton's first press secretary and a consultant for the West Wing, and she, too, has been following the recent process stories about Rahm Emanuel.
The story is a distraction. It's very uncomfortable for Rahm, both because some people are calling for his head and other people are saying if the president had only listened to him. Neither of those are stories that Rahm wants out there, and neither of those are really stories the president wants out there either. I mean, one of the things that's driving this story more than is there a rift between Barack Obama and Rahm Emanuel is there a rift between Barack Obama, the candidate, and Barack Obama, the president?
Right.
And is Rahm Emanuel somehow responsible for going from the presidential candidate who wanted to change Washington as we know it to the president who's become part of the Washington establishment?
You know, the biggest argument made about these kinds of stories is that they take away from, you know, the substantive issues, the policy questions. And I want to play another clip from this episode of The West Wing. This is the press secretary, C.J. Gregg, and she's confronting Danny Concannon. And he is a reporter with The Washington Post who is writing the story about Leo McGarry, President Bartlett's chief of staff.
Who has it?
I do.
You have it?
Yeah.
And you're going to write about it?
Sure.
Why?
Look.
Why?
Because it's news, CJ.
It's not news.
It is.
It's not news just because it's entertaining, Danny.
It's news because the media director of a successful presidential campaign wrote a memo to a leader of the president's party describing his weaknesses.
So clearly CJ Gregg is Dee Dee Myers in the White House. But does she have a point? I mean, are stories like the Rahm Emanuel stories not news?
Well, it depends on how you define news. Is news information that we need to know to make good decisions? Is news something that's entertaining, or is it some combination of the above? This is something we're wrestling with as a broader culture. In terms of trying to control what is news, the White House has a different set of priorities than the news media. The news media wants to maintain its readers and its viewers and make sure that it's interesting and that it's competitive. Any news organization wants to beat its competitors no matter what the story is, whether it's Tiger Woods' confession or, you know, healthcare policy. So the White House will always argue in favor, you know, to define news as things that are good for the White House. So and also, you know, there's an argument that what's good for the American people, is it more important for them to understand the details of the healthcare reform proposal, or is it more important for them to understand the process through which that bill may or may not pass?
But I mean, surely they can understand both, and both can be presented, right? I mean,
there's an imbalance in the amount of information we get about each. People know way more about the process in healthcare than they do about what's in the bill.
You mean the horse trading and the fighting?
Yeah,
and the,
yeah. Whether you know how this is going to work and what got in the bill and what shouldn't have been in the bill. Now, part of that is it's just simple math. The Senate's version of the health care bill passed December 24th. It has not changed. The process for getting that bill to become law has changed pretty much every day and in very dramatic ways. And so that becomes more newsy because news is what's new.
With these stories about Emanuel, the basic premise is, had the president only listened to him a bit more, and we don't know if this is true, but this is the premise, had he listened to him a bit more, perhaps more of his legislative agenda would have passed, would have been accomplished, including healthcare overhaul. That strikes me as a legitimate news story.
Yeah, I mean, it's not to say that every aspect of a process story is not newsworthy. I mean, many are. And again, it goes back to your definition of news. But how things work affects the outcome. And so you can't argue that that's never relevant. Of course it's relevant. But it's in terms of the volume. How much, you know, why do we have 87 stories about Rahm Emanuel, which most Americans care a little bit about, but not that much, and so many fewer stories about what will happen to most the cost of most people's health care should this bill pass. Mm. There's one story, and then news organizations will say, well, we wrote about that once, right? Because the substance didn't change, but the process changed every day for months, and so people know much more about the process. And it ultimately makes it hard to get things done. And so from that perspective, where people get so bogged down in the process and it all looks like sausage getting made and it's not very attractive, and it does undermine our democracy on some sense. That's not to say that they should never be covered, and I don't know how you get the balance right, but that's one of the things that you worry about is, you know, as the White House press secretary or as the chief of staff or as the president, how do you strike some balance so that people actually know what it is you're trying to achieve, not just all the flaws of the process that you're using to actually go about achieving that? And the process is flawed because humans are flawed. Mm.
There was an entire West Wing episode called The Process Story.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about it, the entire series was a process story, which is in part what made it so compelling, which I guess is why we love these stories, right?
Right. I mean, Aaron Sorkin, the brilliant creator of the show, always said that his objective was to he loved pulling back the curtain and showing people what went on in this mysterious place called the West Wing. And he loved the little bits of information. Oh, I remember just incidentally one day saying to him something about the president's going to pardon the turkey, which for whatever reason he didn't know. And he thought that was just he loved those little pieces of information about stuff that went on inside the White House and why did that happen and who got to decide and, you know, just again, pulling back the curtain and letting people see how things happen. But it was process with an idealist's perspective. And that's not necessarily the point of a process story in Washington. It's a Hollywood process story, so it's a rosier gloss.
Has the process story changed since you were in the White House in the early 90s, or is it the same old story again and again? It's just sort of repeat itself again and again.
To a certain degree, yeah, it repeats itself. What's different is there are so many more outlets for the process story, and there's so much more competition for something different that every aspect of the process story becomes a story. People might have been interested in it before, but there was no place to put it. Now there's a place to put it.
That's Dee Dee Meyer. She's a political analyst, a contributing editor to Vanity Fair, and, of course, the press secretary during President Bill Clinton's first term in office. Dee Dee Meyer, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.